It's Scott. It's Thursday, April 2nd, and I am reading from the Christian Science Monitor. The first story is about the Artemis II mission. It is headlined, Letter from Mission Control. Four astronauts soar toward moon, quote, for all humanity. In the first endeavor to orbit the moon in more than half a century, four astronauts launched on the Artemis II mission from Cape Canaveral. A Christian Science Monitor journalist watched the historic step toward a lunar mission from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. It's written by Henry Gass. I've never covered a rocket launch before, so I wasn't quite sure when to exhale. About 3 minutes into the Artemis II mission, with the ship about to enter outer space, I took my cue from Reed Wiseman. We have a beautiful moonrise, and we're headed right at it, the mission commander said, his voice crackling into an auditorium at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. The Artemis II mission, bringing four astronauts on a lunar flyby, is scheduled to last 10 days. For nine of those days, the Johnson Space Center in Houston, home to the NASA Mission Control Center, will be the place to be. On launch day, with most cameras focused on the blastoff from Cape Canaveral, Florida, the work here commenced in a quieter but critical way. The Artemis mission represents NASA's next bold step, a return to the moon for the first time in 50 years, this time with plans to eventually stay. Artemis II will send a four-person crew around the moon and back, perhaps venturing further into space than any humans in history. Artemis IV aims to land humans on the lunar surface in 2028. From there, a nuclear reactor, a moon base, a launch pad into deep space. First stop, Mars. Many commentators this week have drawn parallels between Artemis II and Apollo 8, which orbited the moon in 1968, ahead of Apollo 11's lunar landing, which came the following year. The Johnson Space Center today seems to embody this theme of old and new, of legacy and reinvention. From the outside, the complex here doesn't seem to have changed much from its heyday in the 1960s. The sprawling campus is still populated by squat, rectangular buildings made of solid concrete, brutalist to their core. Inside, however, the sleek logo for the Artemis program is everywhere, its futuristic font making you want to double-check that you're still in the 21st century. The faces of the crew, Mr. Wiseman, pilot Victor Glover, and mission specialists Christina Koch and Jeremy Hansen, look back at you from pictures and one life-sized cardboard cutout. They look ready to boldly go. I had traveled to Houston from my home base in Austin, Texas, to report on Artemis II for the Monitor. Since becoming the Monitor's Texas correspondent in 2016, I had always wanted to cover NASA. Houston is known as Space City, after all. Artemis II felt like the perfect opportunity to watch history get made in my own backyard. I enjoy reading about space technology and exploration in my free time, and while I'm not a PhD-level space nerd, I do think I could understand the science enough, with help from experts, to cover the mission professionally. With the likely exception of Building 30, which is home to the Mission Control Center and off-limits to reporters on Wednesday, the Johnson Space Center was quiet for most of the day. At around 4:30 p.m. local time, a half mile from Building 30, NASA employees and journalists began making their way over to the Teague Auditorium, where a live feed of the launch pad at Kennedy Space Center in Florida was being shown on a screen next to an empty podium. About a dozen employees and journalists, along with three TV camera crews, gathered in the large auditorium. 5:14 p.m. came and went without the countdown clock starting, but it was a minor delay before the seconds began ticking down. If the crew was nervous, they did not sound it. As the launch teams completed their final checks and issued their respective iconic Go for Launch proclamations, Mr. Hansen, the first Canadian astronaut on a lunar mission, added something of a twist. "We are going for all humanity," he said. From my perch in Houston, the launch pad at Cape Canaveral looked beautiful. The towering Space Launch System rocket stood framed by a clear blue sky and capped by a speck of white, the Orion spacecraft, dubbed Integrity by the crew, their home for the next 10 days. Back at the Teague Auditorium, at T-130, phones are taken out of pockets. Cameras are pointed at the screen, recording. A NASA launch commentator tells viewers that the four brave explorers are 248,000 miles from the moon and about to ride, quote, "the most powerful rocket NASA has ever built." The commentator counts down from 10. Then a burst of light, a belching roar, and Artemis II rides a fireball high into the blue sky. The small crowd in the auditorium whoops and claps. Attention still hangs in the air as the fireball dissipates into a thick white smoke plume billowing behind the rocket. Is everyone safe yet? Finally, a voice crackles over the radio, delivering space jargon that made it sound like everything is going well, but left me nonplussed. "Integrity," said Mr. Wiseman aboard the spacecraft. "Guidance converged. Performance nominal. Upper stage RCS ready," he said. 3 minutes and 50 seconds into the mission, the crew crossed the boundary into space, the announcer told us. 8 minutes and 2 seconds into the mission came main engine cutoff, also known as the time the main booster rockets detach and drift into space. The crowd oohed as a camera showed the rocket and what appeared to be a cloud of glittering debris drift away. 23 minutes into the mission, the Artemis II crew has climbed about 600 miles above Earth, traveling at more than 16,000 miles per hour. From here, the astronauts will orbit Earth twice, testing the Orion's systems before beginning an approximately 4-day journey to the moon. Hard numbers and fun statistics are swirling in my head. The record for farthest journey from Earth is 248,655 miles, which Artemis II could break if it follows a certain trajectory. The Orion capsule is about the size of two minivans. The lunar flyby will occur with the ship about 4,000 miles above the moon's surface. To the astronauts, the moon will look about the size of a basketball in your outstretched hand. Space exploration is complicated, but there are ways to make it understandable, and it's a piece of cake to make it exciting. At Cape Canaveral, astronaut Nicole Ayers wiped tears from her eyes a few minutes after the launch. A NASA astronaut since 2022, Nicole took part in the fifth all-women spacewalk at the International Space Station. Ms. Cope took part in the first one in 2019. Ms. Ayers considers all four of the Artemis crew her friends, she said during NASA's live coverage, after they had climbed out of sight and into history. "What a way to welcome in the Artemis generation," she said. This story is headlined, "After more than 100 years of birthright citizenship, the Supreme Court appears skeptical of change." It's written by Henry Gass and Cameron Pugh. A presidential order reinterpreting how the Constitution defies United States citizenship faced a skeptical Supreme Court on Wednesday. The case, Trump v. Barbara, is one of the most important the justices will decide this term. The oral argument, in fact, made history as the first to be attended by a sitting president. Donald Trump left about halfway through the proceedings, according to reports. The case stems from an executive order Mr. Trump issued just hours into his first day back in office. It attempted to redefine the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment and the 1952 Immigration and Nationality Act, which codified the clause into federal law. The clause provides automatic U.S. citizenship to all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Mr. Trump's order would make the children of parents in the country illegally or temporarily, such as those on a student visa, ineligible for citizenship because they are not subject to the jurisdiction of the U.S. government. The order would apply only to future births. The challengers claim that upholding the order would violate the Constitution and upend centuries of settled law. The American Civil Liberties Union led the class action lawsuit on behalf of families whose children's citizenship could be brought into question. The Trump administration, meanwhile, argues that the order is both legal and necessary to crack down on illegal immigration and what they call birth tourism, in which a woman enters the United States solely for the purpose of securing American citizenship for her newborn. Many of the justices sounded skeptical of the government's arguments, however. Chief Justice John Roberts at one point said, "The current interpretation of birthright citizenship certainly wasn't a problem in the 19th century." Solicitor General John Sauer, arguing on behalf of the administration, pushed back, arguing that modern times require a reinterpretation. Unlike the 1800s, he said, foreign visitors are now only an 8-hour flight away. "We're in a new world," he added. Justice Roberts replied, "Well, it's a new world. It's the same Constitution." After he left the Supreme Court, Mr. Trump posted on social media that, quote, "We are the only country in the world stupid enough to allow birthright citizenship," unquote. Actually, about 36 countries provide for unrestricted citizenship at birth. Some around the world have chosen in recent decades to tighten or get rid of their birthright citizenship policies. Lower courts have consistently ruled against the White House's interpretation of birthright citizenship. If the justices rule in the government's favor, there could be as many as 6.4 million U.S.-born children without legal status by the year 2050. That's according to a recent study by researchers at Penn State University. Much of the oral argument on Wednesday focused on a different Supreme Court case, the 1898 decision in United States v. Wong Kim Ark, held that a child born in California to Chinese citizen parents was a U.S. citizen under the 14th Amendment. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 granted automatic citizenship to persons born in the U.S. and not subject to a foreign power. But when Congress codified the Citizenship Clause in the Immigration and Nationality Act, it used the 14th Amendment's subject to the jurisdiction thereof language. One might have expected Congress to use a different phrase if it wanted to try to disagree with Wong Kim Ark on what the scope of birthright citizen should be, said Justice Brett Kavanaugh during oral arguments. But Mr. Sauer told the justices repeatedly they could uphold Mr. Trump's order without overturning Wong Kim Ark. What the court should do, he argued, is acknowledge the importance of the Wong court's use of the term domicile in that decision. The word domicile appears nearly 20 times in the decision, and Mr. Sauer said it refers only to people who are, quote, lawfully present and have an intent to remain permanently, unquote, in the United States. The word jurisdiction, in subject to the jurisdiction thereof, he added, means allegiance, adding, the allegiance of an alien present in another country is determined by domicile. With that argument, the Trump administration is trying to characterize the Wong decision as more narrow than it was, according to Rachel Rosenblum, who's a professor at Northeastern University's School of Law. Instead, she says, The Wong decision establishes a very broad rule of birthright citizenship. The administration, meanwhile, is arguing that unless you're here lawfully, and unless you're domiciled here in the United States, the birthright clause in the 14th Amendment does not apply to you. According to Andrew Arthur, the resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates lower immigration rates. The Wong court, quote, relied upon English common law and feudal principles. But they all flow from the idea that you are a subject to the liege or the king, he adds. What Sauer is getting at is that interpretation of that is not a good fit, and that Wong is not a proper precedent for a republic like ours to follow. The administration's domicile theory preoccupied the justices even during their questions to Cecilia Wang, the national legal director at the American Civil Liberties Union, who represented the challengers. Justice Roberts asked her, "Isn't it at least something to be concerned about, since it's discussed 20 different times?" The practical implications of the Supreme Court upholding Mr. Trump's executive order are noteworthy. Narrowing birthright citizenship in that way would increase the country's unauthorized population by 2.5 million in one decade, according to one recent study. By contrast, the number of birthright tourism cases is much smaller, according to the latest figures from the Center for Immigration Studies. In the year 2020, they found that between 20,000 and 26,000 babies a year are born to a parent flying to the U.S. to give birth. Enforcement could also be a challenge, particularly for parents with certain temporary statuses. Those include asylum seekers and people who are living under temporary protected status, which grants legal status to citizens of countries deemed unsafe to return to because of catastrophes such as natural disasters or war. It's not as simple as documented immigrant versus temporary visa, says Ming Chen, who is a professor at the University of California College of the Law in San Francisco. Temporary visas, she adds, are all very different. Parent status shifts a lot. Those potential practical implications did not get much attention from the justices. Instead, their hours of questions about how to interpret the citizenship clause, the Wong decision, and various associated statutes illustrate how the debates between them will likely focus on the more technical aspects of the case. Those more arcane questions can be boiled down further, according to Mr. Arthur. Is the citizenship clause of the 14th Amendment vague or not, he asks. And if it is vague, how do you interpret it? And who can properly interpret it for legal purposes? A decision in this case is expected by late June or early July. This story is headlined, Deterrence or Escalation? What the Surge of U.S. Troops Might Mean in Iran. It's written by Anna Mulreen Grobe, who is a staff writer. There's a saying often invoked in the run-up to war. If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. The late Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld reportedly cited it privately within the George W. Bush administration as U.S. troops deployed to Baghdad, then publicly in 2013 to criticize President Obama when the United States was fighting the Islamic State in Syria. And while President Trump said this week that America will be ending its war against Iran, quote, very soon, thousands of U.S. troops have continued streaming into the Middle East in a campaign the president says could last another 2 to 3 weeks. In a primetime address on Wednesday night, President Trump declared that the American strategic objectives are, quote, nearing completion. We're going to hit them extremely hard, he said. We're going to bring them back to the Stone Ages, where they belong. We're on track to complete all of America's military objectives shortly, very shortly, he added, claiming that the month-long conflict has been a success, as he tried to assuage high oil and gas prices that have been caused by the war. We have all the cards, he said, and they have none. Still, veterans and analysts warn that the combination of force without a clear end goal in Iran could be a recipe for the kind of mission creep that turned conflicts in Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan into quagmires. For his part, Mr. Trump said last week that he could walk away from the war with or without a deal. But such a move would be difficult to fathom, some analysts say. The Strait of Hormuz is essentially closed for business, driving up gas prices for U.S. voters, which, given this fall's midterm elections, could jeopardize control of Congress by Republicans, the president's party. Iran still has enriched uranium buried underground as well, which could be used to make nuclear weapons. Preventing that possibility is the primary reason Mr. Trump said he went to war in the first place, and the Iranian regime still rules the country. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said on Tuesday that U.S. bases in the region are getting, quote, more and more bunkers, unquote, and that all options remain on the table, including sending in U.S. ground troops to Iran. When a reporter asked Hegseth what he would say to Americans who love the president but are very worried about this notion of boots on the ground, Mr. Hegseth pushed back, saying, I don't understand why the Republican base wouldn't have faith in the president's ability to execute on this. The U.S. military is preparing for a number of possible scenarios, according to analysts. Those include using Army paratroopers or special Marine expeditionary units to seize control of Iranian islands, or perhaps even to occupy them. This could precede or follow missions to sweep mines and escort oil tankers through the Strait of Hormuz, reopening that passage to commercial traffic. Pentagon officials have also likely drawn up several plans for sending U.S. special operations units into Iran to secure enriched uranium. That uranium is believed to be buried under rubble following the massive U.S. bomb strikes on Iran's nuclear sites last June. Open source intelligence reports show increased air traffic from U.S. bases in the region where Delta Force and Ranger Regiment units are currently stationed. Having growing numbers of U.S. forces on hand in the region almost builds up an impetus all on its own, according to retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Brad Taylor, who served in special operations, including 8 years as a commander in the Delta Force. He says this can create momentum to employ ground troops. You've done so much planning, he said, it's almost like, well, I guess we're going to use them. The U.S. military has struck more than 11,000 targets in 30 days, and officials say Iran's ability to deploy missiles is degraded but not destroyed. Yes, they will still shoot some missiles, Mr. Hegseth told reporters, but we will shoot them down. Some administration advisors have argued that an operation like taking Karg Island would be relatively low risk. Michael Rubin, who's a neoconservative analyst, formerly of the Iraq Coalition Provisional Authority, has called it a no-brainer that would protect its oil facilities for a post-war economy. Destroying guard posts on the island sets the stage for U.S. forces to occupy it, wrote Dr. Rubin, who's now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute think tank, amid reports that he's been advising Trump administration officials. Such an operation could still happen, especially if people are telling the president that this would be the easy way out that he's been looking for. That, according to Harrison Mann, who's a former Army major specializing in Middle East analysis at the Defense Intelligence Agency. In a textbook scenario, Karg Island could be taken by 82nd Airborne Division paratroopers parachuting in by plane or by Marines from expeditionary units dropped off by helicopters. The latter would be more dangerous since helicopters have to land at some point, making them relatively easy to strike. Planes carrying airborne troops are targets too, but they don't have to land. Planes are also largely safe from Iranian drones, and fighter jet escorts can suppress remaining Iranian air defenses. But paratroopers land in a dispersed way that could also leave them vulnerable to capture, according to Mr. Mann, who is now the Associate Director for Policy and Campaigns at Win Without War, a network of progressive grassroots organizations. Especially if it's a combat jump, where the aircraft is probably going to be low and fast, it's a hard landing, like you're getting pushed out of a third-story window, Mr. Mann says. Those soldiers are not hitting the ground with their weapons up. Karg Island has a decent-sized civilian population that may or may not have friendly feelings toward U.S. forces. Iran could initially let U.S. troops land unopposed, Mr. Mann says, which could amount to a trap to draw in and potentially even target additional forces. Troops on the ground need to be resupplied. They also need logistical support and medical care, all of which require security escorts. Then there's the matter of extraction, he adds. As dangerous as it is to bring troops onto the island, he says, it's even more dangerous to get them off of it. Keeping Iran from making nuclear weapons has been a reason frequently cited by the administration for beginning the war. The president cited it again this week. Delta Force, which is an elite U.S. Army unit that specializes in raids and high-value target captures, was made for such missions as securing Iran's uranium, with training in securing chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear hazards. But stores of enriched uranium, like those believed to be in Iran, are considered hard and deeply buried targets, which get their own acronym, HDBT, in military parlance. People keep talking about special op forces doing that. We train for things like that, but this is just rubble, says Mr. Taylor, who writes novels about military missions. When it comes to extracting Iran's uranium, he says, given the previous bombing raids, you're not looking at special forces guys, you're looking at engineers with bulldozers. If they were to be sent in, these forces would need a, quote, huge contingent of protection. This could amount, he says, to upwards of 1,000 additional U.S. troops forming a security phalanx around the special forces troops, as well as the military engineers who'd need to accompany them as they do their jobs. Though the United States might get forces on the ground, which without much resistance, Iran could mount pinprick attacks, like single sniper attacks that would drive up U.S. casualties one by one, further inflaming resistance to the war at home in the United States. And even if special forces troops were successful in securing enriched uranium at some sites, there'd be continued questions about how much might still be out there. Hypothetically, some intelligence assessments might conclude that there are 5 canisters of the material left, others 10, for example. If the U.S. finds 8, could the intelligence be wrong? Or could 2 canisters be missing? Mr. Taylor says it's hard to prove a negative. For now, Mr. Hegseth says the administration will not foreclose any options in Iran, although the defense secretary acknowledges that this refusal could be a strategic feint. You can't fight and win a war if you tell your adversary what you're willing to do or what you're not willing to do, Hegseth told reporters. Our adversary right now thinks there are 15 different ways we could come at them, with boots on the ground. And guess what? There are. This story about the economy and politics is headlined, Insider Trading: Why Well-Timed Market Plays Are Raising Alarms in Washington. It's written by Christian Science Monitor staff writer Linda Feldman. Reports of big payouts from market trades that appeared to foresee major actions by the Trump administration, potentially with insider information, are becoming increasingly common. Last week, the oil futures market saw a spike in trades about 15 minutes before President Trump announced a pause in plans to attack Iranian power plants. The unidentified trader or traders had placed more than $500 million in trades, according to calculations by the Financial Times. Similarly, the prediction market Polymarket saw a sharp increase in bets that proved lucrative right before the United States went to war against Iran and, earlier, invaded Venezuela. Critics say these well-timed, anonymous market plays strongly suggest insider trading from people either in or close to the Trump administration. They say that traders appear to be getting confidential information about major news that will move markets, and then placing trades just before it happens, winning a big payoff. This is just astounding corruption, said Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut in a recent social media video. There are a bunch of millionaires and billionaires in this country who are making money off of their inside information, as well as their access to what President Trump is going to do or what he's going to say. The White House denies any wrongdoing by administration officials. The only focus of President Trump and his administration officials is doing what's best for the American people, said Deputy White House Press Secretary Kush Desai in a statement. The White House doesn't tolerate any administration official illegally profiteering off of insider knowledge, and any implication that officials are engaged in such activity without evidence is baseless and irresponsible reporting. Suspicions of impropriety have sparked a wave of legislation, some of it bipartisan, in both houses of Congress. Senator Murphy, along with Representative Greg Kasar of Texas, another Democrat, has introduced a bill aimed at banning prediction markets from wagering on government actions, terrorism, war, assassination, and events where an individual knows or controls the outcome. But some experts say new laws are unlikely to fix the problem. Todd Phillips, an assistant professor of law at Georgia State University's business school, says insider trading is already illegal. Enforcement is the real issue, he says. The Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which governs U.S.-based prediction markets in addition to commodity futures markets, has a dearth of enforcement attorneys, according to Barron's. And the CFTC only has jurisdiction in the U.S., while most of Polymarket's business is offshore. The CFTC approved a U.S.-facing site last year, which is still not fully operational. But Americans can use a virtual private network, or VPN, to access the offshore site and operate free of government regulation. Concern about prediction markets and conflicts of interest has revived calls for a ban on stock trades by members of Congress, and it has put additional scrutiny on President Trump's soaring personal fortune, now estimated at $6.5 billion and up almost $1.5 billion from March 2025, including gains from his cryptocurrency ventures and licensing business. Last week, a Justice Department memo revealed that the classified documents Mr. Trump was charged with illegally retaining in 2021, in a case that was later dismissed, had been related to his business interests. To some ethics experts, it all underscores an alarming erosion in norms preventing public officials from profiting off government work or connections, norms intended to reassure voters that their officials were putting the interests of the country ahead of their own. Today, just 17% of the U.S. public trusts the federal government to do what is right for the country. That's down from 77% in 1964, according to the Pew Research Center. Analysts say the problem is broader and symptomatic of a government that has simply grown too powerful and too entwined with the economy and markets. The underlying problem is not the insider trading. It's public corruption, says Adam Michel, who is an economist at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He adds, it's the fact that government has inserted itself so deeply into so many different markets and has so much influence on market outcomes. Polymarket and Kalshi, another prediction market platform, both took steps last week aimed at preventing insider trading. Polymarket updated its rules to make clear that users can't make trades based on confidential information. Kalshi announced a ban on political candidates trading on their own campaigns and said it would block anyone from college or professional sports from making trades in sports they're involved in. Those moves came as Democratic Senator Adam Schiff of California and Republican Senator John Curtis of Utah introduced legislation that would ban prediction markets from creating sports-related contracts and give states regulatory control rather than the federal government. Mr. Schiff dismissed the company's statements as aspirational. 2 days later, in the House, Democratic Representative Nikki Budzinski of Illinois and Republican Representative Adrian Smith of Nebraska unveiled a bill that would prohibit members of Congress and the executive branch from prediction market trades on politics or policy. States are also getting into the act, with more than a dozen moving to regulate prediction markets. Last week, Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom of California banned state appointees with insider information from participating in such markets. That same day, Washington State sued CalSheaf for facilitating what it called illegal gambling. In just a few years, the prediction markets have become a global phenomenon with international impact. In the middle of last month, an Israeli journalist told the Washington Post that online gamblers had pressured him to change his blog post about an Iranian missile strike so they could win a payout on Polymarket. The reporter said he faced threats to his own and his family's safety if he did not comply, and from one trader, a share of the winnings if he did. He did not change his report. Last month, an Israeli Air Force reservist was indicted on multiple offenses related to alleged betting on Polymarket on the timing of Israel's opening strike against Iranian nuclear facilities last year. Concern about insider trading came to the forefront last year when Mr. Trump's tariff war was causing wild swings in the stock market. ProPublica reported that U.S. executive branch employees as well as congressional aides had sold stocks right before the president's initial big tariff announcement, which sent markets plummeting. Days later, when Mr. Trump announced a pause on those tariffs, causing markets to soar, some investors made big profits. Even if there was no insider trading, the appearance of possible impropriety threatened to harm public confidence, according to ethics experts. Today, the big issue is prediction markets and whether or how to regulate them. In a recent news conference that introduced his legislation, Senator Murphy stepped back and posed a larger question. What happens to us spiritually when every moral question in this country just becomes a market, he asked. Don't we lose something? It's really important that there are certain matters that are not monetized by prediction markets, he said, whether that be humanitarian disaster overseas or the fundamental question of whether we go to war or not. This is a Christian Science Monitor editorial by the Monitor's editorial board. It is headlined, Truth-Seeking Russians Try to Save Telegram. After more than 4 years of war in Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin might be discovering that adherence to truth and open communication can be essential to assuring a motivated military. A Kremlin attempt to steadily shut down Russia's most popular and effective messaging platform, known as Telegram, has stirred dissent among civilian volunteers who assist the war effort online. They are the patriotic digital influencers who arrange money and supplies, the resources the military does not reliably provide, for soldiers who are on the front lines. Without free access to an independent app like Telegram, which has already been slowly throttled for months, this civil society of auxiliary supporters could turn on the government. Morale in the army ranks might fall fast. Spotty access to Telegram has also begun to reduce the ability of soldiers to message their families. All military work goes through Telegram. All communication, a Russian soldier told Politico magazine. That would be like shooting the entire Russian army in the head. A government-backed new app called Max is widely seen as inadequate in its capabilities, as well as an attempt to control all digital communication and cut Russia off from the outside world. For many Russians, an open internet is essential to survive Ukrainian missile attacks. One governor of a region near Ukraine told the New York Times that Telegram is necessary for air raid alerts. Disruptions to the messaging service have led to needless deaths, he said. In March, one well-known blogger, Ilya Remeslor, who had been loyal to Mr. Putin, turned on the Kremlin for its strangling of internet and media freedoms. He has since been put in a psychiatric ward. Frequent internet blackouts and the loss of access to foreign apps, such as YouTube, have already disrupted daily life. Memes have made fun of Russians using paper maps, pagers, and walkie-talkies. Last week, protests in defense of Telegram were planned in more than 24 cities and towns, but were prevented by local officials. And as more people rush to use censor-skirting VPNs, virtual private networks, officials are clamping down on those, too. A survey released last month found 83% of teenagers have reacted negatively to the internet restrictions. Nearly half of the teenagers said they were angry, and 15% said they were crying. The Russian inventor of Telegram, tech billionaire Pavel Durov, who now lives in self-exile in the United Arab Emirates, said the Kremlin's moves on free speech are a, quote, sad spectacle of a state afraid of its own people. Yet his fellow citizens' response to the expected end of Telegram could end up being a force for freedom. And the same ideal of liberty, it turns out, is just what the people of Ukraine are defending. This editorial from the Christian Science Monitor editorial board is headlined EU and Canada Lean into a New World Role. At the start of this week, a four-day gathering of the World Trade Organization ended in deadlock over a disagreement between just two of its 166 member countries. The United States sought a 10-year extension to existing duty-free digital purchasing rules for items such as software, music, and movies. Brazil would only agree to a 2-year extension. Nevertheless, working on the sidelines, 66 other member nations from Asia, Europe, and the Americas forged their own agreement on the issue. The recent increase in such minilateral solutions to global obstacles signifies more than mere impatience with time-consuming multilateral processes. Rather, it highlights the impetus and realization among the world's middle powers about their changing role and responsibility in shaping a world order amid major geopolitical shifts. Middle powers are seeking ways to lessen overdependence on the world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China, while also crafting new interdependent relationships with a wider range of partners. Middle powers have the potential to help stabilize global order and advance cooperation, according to Stuart Patrick, who's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He says the range of potential issue areas for cooperation is vast and includes trade, climate action, and energy security, as well as digital technology and support for the international rule of law. The European Union and Canada, both longtime allies that the U.S. has recently shunned, are at the forefront of this trend. In January, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney urged a move toward what he described as building coalitions that work, issue by issue, with partners who share enough common ground to act together. He dubbed this a policy of variable geometry, based on shared values and interests. In the 2 months since his speech at the Davos World Economic Forum, Mr. Carney has traveled to Asia and Australia to hold trade talks. Ursula von der Leyen, president of the European Union, has also logged many air miles. In the first 3 months of 2026, she helped conclude three significant free trade negotiations with the five-country Mercosur bloc in South America, as well as with India and Australia. That first deal, in discussion for 25 years, signals that the EU can still deliver, even if slowly, according to the Policy Center for the New South. For those nations, it's a recognition of agency, including, instead of choosing between China's purchasing power and Washington's attention, the bloc gains a third pillar, Europe's market and political stability. Both sides, the Morocco-based center said, benefit from what the other can offer, balance, resources, stability. Referring to the United States' retreat from a range of alliances and pacts, Dr. Patrick of Carnegie believes that emerging middle powers can fill the leadership vacuum. This is their opportunity, he wrote in January, to defend what should be preserved, jettison what is obsolete, and renegotiate rules so that they work better for all. This last editorial from the Christian Science Monitor's editorial board is headlined, When Spring Bursts Forth with Renewal. Politics in Washington might be downbeat and divided, but nothing unites the U.S. Capitol and many thousands of tourists in a spirit of optimism and anticipation like the spring blossoms of the city's iconic cherry trees. Peak bloom, peak bloom, peak bloom. It's official, the National Park Service gleefully announced online on Thursday of last week. The news confirmed that the last weekend in March was going to be the best time to visit the Tidal Basin and the National Mall, joining in conversation and contemplation along the pink-colored and perfumed walkways lined with more than 3,000 Japanese cherry trees given as a gift by the city of Tokyo in 1912. The first cherry trees helped crystallize an image of what Washington could look like. Thomas Lubke, Secretary of the U.S. Commission of Fine Arts, said on the centenary of the gift that helped transform and soften the landscape of the United States' seat of power. For students of history and culture, the cherry tree's delicate flowers and gnarled trunks speak to the enduring soft power of global goodwill, culture, and faith in a better future to overcome division, including wartime enmity and destruction. After Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, the cherry trees in Washington were occasionally vandalized. But in 1952, as the United States shepherded post-World War II reconstruction, budwood from the Washington trees was transferred to Tokyo to restore the damaged original parent grove. This year, an additional 250 cherry trees sent by Japan to commemorate the 250th anniversary of U.S. independence will be planted in Washington. Beyond political gestures, cherry blossom celebrations point to near-universal interpretations of springtime as a season of renewal and of fresh beginnings. The Japanese practice of hanami, gathering with family and friends to view the blossoms, share conversation, and enjoy leisurely picnics, has spread around the U.S. as well, to cities including London, Paris, and Stockholm. In an international context that currently feels fragile or fractured, and alongside increasing isolation, especially among urban populations, this spring tradition spreads a priceless joy and connection. The Washington Post last year highlighted a couple who have held a sunrise picnic during cherry blossom time for more than 25 years and are now regularly recognized and greeted by fellow passersby. As the Japanese poet Kobayashi Issa expressed in a classic haiku about 200 years ago, under the cherry blossoms, strangers are not really strangers. The story from the economics section is headlined, With Iran War Squeezing Global Energy, Nations Are Looking to Nuclear and Renewables. It's written by Laurent Belsey, a staff writer. Dateline Houston. The war in Iran is not only boosting the price of oil and natural gas, but it is also causing energy short nations to rethink their energy strategies and focus on homegrown alternatives. As a stopgap solution, some nations are turning to coal. But the bigger potential winners are green technologies and nuclear power. Nations are taking different paths. For example, already a nuclear power heavyweight, France is boosting its nuclear power generation and exports. This month, its reactors are on track to produce the most power of any March over the past 7 years, according to Bloomberg. Its power exports are double last year's level. Germany, which shut down most of its nuclear reactors a decade ago, is ramping up its renewables. This week, its federal cabinet adopted a climate action program that, among other green initiatives, will boost by 2,000 the number of wind turbines that the nation plans to build. The plan will reduce our dependency on expensive and unreliable oil and gas imports, according to Environment Minister Carsten Schneider. Hit by war-related shortages of liquefied natural gas, India is turning to coal to meet an expected surge of summer air conditioning demand. Even Germany reopened coal plants it had recently shuttered when Russia cut natural gas exports in the wake of the start of the war in Ukraine. That is a boon to coal exporters, such as coal-powered South Africa. Local mining company Exxaro Resources forecast last week that its coal sales abroad from South Africa could jump 12% this year. But the long-term winners are expected to be green energy and nuclear power. Nations were already moving in those directions before the U.S.-Israel bombing of Iran began on February 28th. Supply disruptions of oil and gas caused by the war, especially Iran's effective closure of the Strait of Hormuz, are adding new urgency to the issue. How much urgency that shift in direction takes will depend, in part, on how long the U.S. and Israel's war with Iran lasts and how much it destroys Gulf oil and natural gas infrastructure. After Iran rejected a 15-point peace plan that had been put forward by the Trump administration, the Pentagon is reportedly considering sending up to 10,000 additional ground troops to the Middle East. More than 2,000 other U.S. troops are already in the region to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Here in Houston, the world's largest energy conference is underway. Experts are cautious about the war's long-term impact on accelerating the move toward green energy and nuclear power. Ernest Moniz, who's a former U.S. Energy Secretary and founder of the EFI Foundation, says it will get some additional impetus. But my caution is that there have been previous big dislocations of the oil markets, and the lessons have been short-lived. It's too early to tell, says Laurent Audet, chief commercial officer of the Urenco Group, which is an international uranium enrichment company. Even in the United States, which produces enough energy to meet American demand, the race to build artificial intelligence data centers is spurring a push to build and reopen nuclear power plants. It is a defining moment, said Ho Nye, chair of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, who was speaking here in Houston last week. The things we do today are going to secure our nation's energy security and help us reestablish global leadership if we all work together. The Trump administration has sped up the process of developing domestic nuclear power by streamlining, permitting, and other regulatory moves. The Energy Department is in talks with Japanese and South Korean companies to help finance the construction of new reactors in the United States. On the green energy front, however, the administration has pumped the brakes with dramatic reductions in federal funding and a pause on permitting for wind turbines. Last week, the Interior Department announced that Washington would pay the French company Total Energies $1 billion to abandon two U.S. offshore wind leases and instead fund fossil fuel projects. Here are some book reviews from the Christian Science Monitor's reviewers. Fiction titles those reviewers liked best. Son of Nobody by Yann Martell. The Life of Pi author Yann Martell again flexes his extraordinary imagination in this latest novel. A Canadian classicist, stalled on his dissertation about Homer's Iliad, leaves his wife and young daughter, named Helen, of course, for a year-long fellowship at Oxford. The scholar, Harlow Don, becomes obsessed by fragments of Greek text on scraps of shredded parchment, which he patches together to create an inventive account of the Trojan War from the perspective not of gods or nobility, but of commoners, including a son of nobody named Soas. The pages of the novel are split horizontally. There's the so-called lost epic, which Harlow dubs the Soad, on the upper half, and his highly personal commentary below, which links the horror and insensibility of the war with the tragic loss of his marriage and young daughter. Son of Nobody joins other brilliant novels involving deranged scholars, including Vladimir Nabokov's Pale Fire. That review is from Heller McAlpin. The next book, entitled Python's Kiss, by Louise Erdrich. Award-winning author Louise Erdrich follows up The Mighty Red with a new collection of short stories teeming with snakes and cats, travelers and troubadours, survivors and secrets. While the speculative fiction wobbles, most of the stories grab and hold. The Hollow Children, a haunting chronicle of a bus driver piloting his morning pickup of schoolchildren through a blizzard, and Amelia, about the friendship between an antsy teenage girl and the stylish customer who frequents the local KFC during her shifts, are standouts. That review from Aaron Douglas. I Hope You Find What You're Looking For, by Bisrat Meghzebi. In her winning debut novel, Meghzebi aims a compassionate eye and skilled pen on the tight-knit Eritrean community in Washington, D.C. Central to the tale are 12-year-old bookworm Lydia, her former freedom fighter mom Elsa, their generous injera-making neighbor Zudi, and a newly arrived cousin with big thoughts of his own. As the storytelling shifts between Washington in 1991 and Elsa's rebel days in Eritrea 15 years earlier, each character grapples with family, purpose, and the pursuit of ideals. That's also written by Aaron Douglas. That's all for today. I'm Scott. It's been a pleasure being with you.